What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
This land is your land. This land is my land. John, this land... Well, you are a man of the land, John.
A man of the land. I've never been called a man of the land.
Well, I will never forget that when I was in my early radio days, there was a gentleman, I'm not going to give his real name, but he called himself Bob Akers.
Bob Akers. No, I don't recall that.
So I called him the man of the land.
Ah,
Bob Akers.
Akers, that makes sense.
Oh, there was an interesting story about
it's like
him.
Green Acres.
Well, the land is really important. And a lot of the land in America, and I think you recognize this clearly, is not land that can be developed. It is land that is set aside, preserved, and protected for various reasons.
And it's really beautiful land, a lot of it, that I've got to see more of it. But
well, I'm planning to see more of it. In fact, my wife and I were talking just yesterday about one of the things that I've always wanted to do, and that is, and you're not going to believe this, John.
I know you're not, because
you know me pretty well. But I've always wanted to rent a houseboat.
Wow.
On Lake Powell in Arizona, Utah, that area.
Yeah.
And just kind of go down slowly meandering around the lake.
Wow.
It's a big lake. It's not like Lake Quassipog near where we live.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about a big old lake. And I've always wanted
relaxing.
To do that. Well, it is relaxing. We had a conversation with a woman yesterday about it. Because we wanted to know, because we're about ready to celebrate our 40th anniversary, and we were thinking of taking the kids with us for something unique and different. But unfortunately, we got married in January. It's not a great time to do Lake Powell January.
Well, I don't know. In Arizona?
Well, it does, Arizona can be chilly.
Okay.
They were telling us that the highs are 50 and the lows 40.
Okay,
that's not the best.
No, that's not the most comfortable.
but what I was saying to my wife is, when we do this, what I'd like to do, and maybe I got taken in by the tourism campaign that Utah did, but they've got 5 national parks, and they say, come and visit them all.
Yeah, that'd be
wonderful. And I'd love to do that.
Yeah, me too. I'd want to go and see Yellowstone and...
Yeah.
See the big, what is it, the Smolin trees or whatever?
The sequoias?
Sequoias, that's it.
Well, there are so many things to see and so much incredible natural habitat. And a lot of that is protected. I think it's about a third of the land in America is actually under federal control. Yeah. We've seen a lot of disputes and debates about that land and about logging on it. And, you know, not only just the national parks, but there's much more of the preserve that is set aside.
Right. A lot of cattle problems, with cattle grazing problems on federal land.
Exactly. And of course, you know, as we have these debates about what is the proper role of government in our society, obviously people are going to have debates about, well, how much land should the federal government own and how much should be put out so that others can participate in the land and maybe benefit from what it is that comes from the land. So these are really interesting questions today in America, as are so many about what is the federal role in our lives.
I think, though, the national parks is, I mean, for what I've seen on Ken Burns and then going up to Maine and seeing that national park, I mean, they're just jewels. They really are, and they keep them that way.
Well, there's a group called PERC.org, and they did a report on the future of public lands. And Holly Fretwell was one of the authors of this report. And all is not well, they say, on these public lands because of all the disputes that you were mentioning.
Right.
And we sat down, of course, with Holly to talk about this because, well, we've got wildfires, we know that, and they're burning millions of acres every year. But there's a debate about that, and on a future podcast, we actually deal with that.
Right.
And we're going to put those two together. So we'll release one about the future of public lands and the other about wildfires and the best way to manage them. But John, I think you and I have seen on television these armed conflicts that have erupted over grazing rights.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's crazy, the federal government coming in and dragging people away. And, you know, I guess I don't quite understand how they lease the land to these, you know, I don't understand the whole, what it's all about and why they're taking it away. And so, but I tell you, they get pretty violent. Whew.
Well, I think that's exactly the reason that you and I wanted to do this podcast, is because something that we take for granted, it's pristine, it's set aside, and yet we don't think about the daily struggle that goes on.
Right.
Because there are people who look at these lands and say, look at the value that this might have if I could do X, Y, or Z on it. And yet we've got the federal government protecting it or limiting its uses. So we're going to be talking about all of that with Holly Fretwell today. And there are these battles that you and I have seen over the national monument designations,
right.
And this goes from Beer's Ears in southeastern Utah to the North Woods of Maine. And, you know, you look at it and you say, well, why would this be walled away from all the conflict that we have about our society today? I mean, it just doesn't make sense that we wouldn't argue about this too, right?
That we argue about everything, yes.
I mean, it comes as no surprise to me that we need to do a podcast about the future of public lands.
We do.
And a lot of these lands are, of course, in the American West. Now, we live in the American East, you and I.
Right.
And we love the East, but it's much more developed. I think Acadia is the only national park on the East Coast. No, it is in Maine.
Yep, in Maine, yeah.
But think as you go out west, the wide open expanse. So we're kind of away from the day-to-day struggles that go on out there.
Right. You're absolutely right.
So we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about the conflicts, perhaps some of the ways that we can resolve these. And PERC, through Holly Fretwell, has a desire to see more public-private involvement working together on some of these issues. So she might have a perspective that you haven't heard before. And I think it's really important to do that. And then ultimately, you'll hear another podcast about wildfires. And they're in the news today as well. So why don't we go on to Holly Fretwell.
Let's do that.
And we'll talk about the future of our public lands.
Joining us today on AmericaTrendsPodcast.com is Holly Fretwell, Outreach Director and Research Fellow at the Property and Environment Research Center. And Holly, tell us a little bit about your organization.
Well, PERC looks at environmental issues from a free market perspective. We essentially take a look at the environment and what's happening in the environment. And if you go back to 1980 when we were founded, all environmental issues and problems that were occurring were sort of thrown at the government, and the government was supposed to solve these problems for us. And what we've done over the last 35-plus years is look at where the government is trying to take care of some of these problems and realizing that they're not really resolving the issues very well for us oftentimes. And so our goal is to figure out why they're not resolving these issues and to try to come up with some better solutions. And we have really focused on property rights and markets to help provide those solutions for us.
Okay, we will talk about that. I'd like to lay out some of the issues. When we look at it, and your report, The Future of Public Lands, is really the basis for this conversation. And tell us, I mean, we've got one-third of the land in the United States, you tell us, that is owned by the federal government. How much of that is really something that we can visit, a place that is curated and preserved and a place that is actively looking for Americans to traverse it, versus just wild land? Explain that.
Well, actually, a lot of that are places that we can go visit. Whether you are interested in actually hiking in there to go see it or not is another question. But most of it is open to the public to access in our national parks. We can access those lands. Again, a lot of those lands are not road accessible, so you can certainly get out there and hike or bike or take horseback. If you're looking at other types of public lands, you can go on off-road vehicles, ATVs, et cetera, to get out there. But I think there's oftentimes some confusion between the different types of public lands that we have, and that would be we have our national park system that most people are thinking of when they're going out to the public lands.
And just remind people of the national parks versus what they might think of as a national park, but it may be a state park. I mean, give us the larger ones and put it in context for us.
Oh, okay. So if we're thinking of our national parks, we can think of these big, huge destination parks such as Yellowstone National Park or Glacier National Park, the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, lots of these big destination parks. We also have a lot of smaller parks that are within the National Park Service, and they are cultural centers and historic parks and battlefields. Then we also, in addition to that, we have lots of state lands and state parks that exist out there. Almost every state has some form of state park system. They are all managed very differently, some very similar to the national park system, some not so much. But I think the big clarification that needs to be made here is our national parks compared to our Forest Service and our BLM lands, which is the Bureau of Land Management lands, because the Forest Service and BLM lands are managed for what we call multiple uses, and that's where we see a lot of the conflict occurring amongst different people that are desiring different uses of these lands, whether we're looking at them for logging and grazing and some sort of commodity extraction or for recreation. And if we're looking at them for recreation, is it for roaded type vehicles or is it for wilderness type use or is it for maybe instead we want biodiversity and wildlife and habitat? So they are to be managed for all of those different types of uses, and sometimes those different types of uses come into conflict with each other.
And we see that from time to time. We will see people who are really kind of settling in on some public lands and suggesting that perhaps there are grazing rights that they should have available to them. I mean, but are those conflicts often in the open, or are there many of them that are simmering out there that we just don't read about?
I think there's a lot of them in the open and a lot of them that are simmering. If we're talking about grazing rights, we actually have ranchers that own base land that grazing rights are tied to. And so those are really grazing issues that exist out there on the landscape. And the individuals that want to see these lands used for alternatives have a really hard time getting beyond the legislation that requires grazing on those landscapes. Because if you have a grazing right and you are not grazing on your land for a 3 to 5 year period, you may lose the right to graze on that land. And somebody else can pick up that right, but they can't pick it up, say, for conservation or for wildlife habitat. They have to be grazing on that land. One interesting point is if you want to graze bison on the landscape, that is actually considered livestock grazing. So if you want to return bison to the range, then that is one way you might be able to do it, is to pick up some of these base ranch lands and graze those animals on it. But if you're looking to protect a different type of species, let's say a tortoise or something of that sort, and you want to buy a grazing right to protect that tortoise, you can't do that under the existing legislation.
Do you think that the legislation that we have written and the rules and the regulations are limiting the prospects for these parks and these preserves, or do we have enough vision to anticipate the many uses in 2017 for these parks?
Again, I think we need to separate what we're talking about when we're looking at parks and our other multiple-use lands. The parks are a smaller component when we're looking at the overall landscape and the amount of acreage that exists out there. Parks are presumably set aside to preserve for the cultural aspects, the wildlife, the various amenities that exist there, and for human enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
But they really are more for conservation of the things that are existing on those landscapes. So if we think of Yellowstone National Park and we have the geysers out there, we're not going to be tearing into those geysers and trying to mine something out of them. That is already protected under the National Park Service bylaws. But if we're looking at our Forest Service or BLM lands, and again, these are recreation areas that we use and we can think of them with great beauty and in lots of different conservation aspects that exist on them, there's a lot more animosity as to how those lands should be used and whether we should be protecting them more for conservation ideas or we should be pulling some more timber out of them or allowing for those grazing rights, et cetera. So national parks, for example, very few national parks actually allow grazing on them, only if that was grandfathered in to the original legislation for that particular park.
Now, we know the Interior Department manages this land. And does it change the philosophy from one administration to another? I mean, how much of the politics of our time are then, laid upon the various issues on these public lands?
Well, we certainly see different opinions from different administrations as to how these lands should be managed. And under the current administration, we see a lot of push towards opening these lands up a little bit more. Again, more of that would be on our Bureau of Land management lands. If we're looking at Department of Interior, they are the overseers of the BLM and the National Parks. Department of Agriculture actually is the overseer of the Forest Service. But we look at these different administrations, and they definitely push for different things and try to protect in different areas, but they all have to respond to the existing set of laws and legislation that come with the different agencies. And that hasn't changed a lot in recent times. It's very slow incremental changes, I should say, in regards to that legislation for the different public lands.
And does Congress get involved actively? I mean, much is grinding to a standstill in Congress. What about policies related to these public lands?
Right. Well, I think the biggest influence that Congress has is in budgeting, and Congress does appropriate the budgets for these various different agencies, and they do have influence as to how things are going to be managed just based on what sort of budgets they are providing. One of the budgeting problems that exists is that a lot of times the revenues that are generated on these various landscapes are put back into the general treasury, and then Congress reallocates some of those monies back out for covering those budgets. But what that does is it makes the land managers much more responsive to Congress and politicians than to individuals that are using the land. Say if as a recreationist I am actually taking my fees and paying as I enter into Yellowstone, and those fees are kept in the park, which actually recreation fees now are kept in the parks, those fees are kept in the park, those managers then are going to pay attention to me and what I'm looking for in that park experience to ensure that I'm coming back and having a good quality experience rather than going back to Congress if they're taking that money back to Congress and then having to reallocate those funds. So keeping revenues on the ground for management purposes helps connect this link between the management of that area and the visitors of that area.
Now, I have read where the national parks are having a lot of financial troubles. Roads, historic buildings, visitor facilities, water sewer systems are not doing terribly well. Tell us what is going on in terms of the maintenance of these places.
Okay, we do have nearly $12 billion backlog on the national parks.
$12 billion.
And part of $12 billion. I think in the last data that I looked at, it was $11.9 billion of a backlog in deferred maintenance. And these are projects that we need to get completed. They are behind schedule in getting them completed. They're just not getting done. And those monies are typically coming from appropriations from Congress. And if you think about how politicians appropriate funds and the incentives of a politician really wants to be providing benefits that people can see today. And so we're taking care of today's issues. Look at me. I've done something wonderful. I want to make sure that any expenditures I have some very visible benefits. If you look at maintenance issues in general, these are sort of things that need to be taken care of on a day-to-day basis, but there's not a big, huge crown at the end of the tunnel saying, ta-da-da, look what I just did. I just produced this wonderful new park or this wonderful new interpretive center, right? This is, I am maintaining the roads. I'm filling the holes in the roads. And so it's not very glamorous. And as a result, when we look at political appropriations, we don't tend to get a whole lot of money for maintenance projects. And as a result of that, we get this backlog of continually growing maintenance issues that are not being taken care of.
And what are those maintenance issues that are most pronounced? The trails, the fisheries, you mentioned the interpretive services. What really seems to be lacking and lagging these days?
Well, I think we get a little bit of everything out there, but some of the ones that are most apparent that sometimes politicians can't actually come back around and save the day on are that when we find leaking sewer systems and antiquated water systems and things that are really causing major environmental damage, this is an occurrence because we've lacked this day-to-day maintenance year after year after year. But when we start to see that, then suddenly we have this crisis management that occurs sometimes, and politicians can come say, hey, here I am with a whole bunch of money to solve this problem. Now, they weren't there when we asked for it, you know, over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but when it's a really big crisis and suddenly it becomes clear to constituents that it's a really big crisis, then that money oftentimes tends to come forward. So the biggest issues we don't really see, right? They're these small issues that are just occurring year after year after year until it gets big enough, and then we might actually see some money put forth for it, but it's costing us a lot more both in financial terms and in environmental terms to do it that way.
Now, I remember the great documentary series that Ken Burns did on the national parks where he said this was one of America's great ideas. And as I'm reading your materials, the national parks were supposed to be self-supporting. Is that correct?
Yes, originally the national parks were to be self-supporting, and the revenues that were generated in those parks were returned to the parks. And if you go back to some of the early fees in the parks, back to Yellowstone, early auto fees for Yellowstone National Park were in the tune of about $100 a day if you were to put that into today's dollars. And if you look at what it actually is now, it's about... Well, what is it? I think it's $80 so that you can visit all parks for the entire year, something of that sort.
And so what happened here? I mean, was it that the constituents were saying, well, look, this is my land, this is your land. We won't go into Pete Seeger's song, or Woody Guthrie's song, I should say. But so what happened? I mean, were constituents saying, we want this to be cheap, and we don't want to think about paying on a subscriber basis or a visitor basis? Well, what happened?
Well, I think there's lots of different theories that exist out there, but in large part it was just creating this national park system and trying to get this sort of cohesive unit that existed out there. And some of these national parks can easily generate revenues to cover their cost, and others cannot. And if you are a politician in a region that you want a national park because your constituents want that national park, being able to create that park and have federal dollars for it is a heck of a lot easier than trying to create that park and have it be entirely self-sufficient. And particularly if you go back into the early days of our national park system when transportation was extremely difficult and costly, there were not a lot of visitors there, and so it was much more difficult, especially for small areas, to generate those revenues.
So here we are today. We've got these treasures. Are we building more national parks and preserves that are looking at financial difficulties just as the backlog we talked about? Or are we pretty much set with a land that we're going to set aside in this way to be a national park?
We continue to add acreage to our national park system, though not in huge chunks at one time. What we are tending to do instead is to take lands that are already federal lands and set them aside as more preserved-type lands, such as the national monuments and some of those issues that we see. But something interesting that I want to bring up here with this regard, if somebody has this huge expanse of land that they want to set aside in today's world, they can do a couple of different things. They can lobby Congress here in the United States and try to create a new national park, and they may or may not be successful. And if we look up at the woods in North Maine, there are, you know, there's proposals going on right there and to create these new national park type areas. But there's another really interesting one that I think people should be aware of, and that is here in Montana in the eastern part of the state called the American Prairie Reserve. And the American Prairie Reserve decided that they wanted to see a larger expanse of American prairie, of the Longgrass Prairie, and realized that putting it under federal control was going to be extremely difficult, extremely costly, and that the federal government has not done a very good job taking care of the landscape. So they decided they were going to do it privately. And they have a goal to set aside 3.5 million acres of land in eastern Montana. Some of that is private and some of that is public. And they have gotten donations in order to purchase lands, private lands, by willing sellers. It's all a voluntary trade. They've raised $100 million. They've purchased 26 different lands. They are piecing together these private and public lands, and they are trying to motivate ranchers in the region that are not interested in selling to be more conservation savvy. And to do this, they are actually providing compensation for ranchers that will do no-till agricultural production, that will allow elk to graze, that will allow bear and cougars to be on their landscape, etc., trying to take a much more market-oriented approach. And they have been very successful so far at trying to expand this landscape and also allow for recreation on it.
Is that something that is being modeled in other places?
I think that if you look at a global scale, there are certainly other similar examples, probably in a much smaller scale. I don't know of any other type of situation like that here in the United States. I think it's a new model for our perspective, and it's also an experimental one. They continue to adapt and adjust as they see what's working and what's not.
I think in many realms, a lot of states see the federal government as being good at various things and not good at others, and maybe even the management of these federal lands or how the money is allocated or does it get back to the parks and so forth is one of those areas. And so states, of course, they're able to do what they wish with their state parks. How much can we learn from the way states are managing their parks when it comes to how we manage some of these federal lands? Can we learn a lot from them?
We have looked at that at PERC, and I say we're not learning quite as much as we'd like to, because most of our state parks are run very similar in the sense that the state legislature is appropriating funds for the state park system, and the state parks that are generating revenues are putting that money back into the state legislature and having some reallocation. Where we really see some interesting things happen is when states are having some sort of financial crisis, they tend to cut the funding for their state parks, and then state parks suddenly respond to this by doing all sorts of amazingly creative things to raise their own funds. They tend to do a really good job when they have to raise their own funds, but as soon as the state legislature or the state financial system is back in better shape, then they tend to say, oh, no, you can't charge fees for these recreation areas anymore. We're going to provide you these appropriations. And so these experiments are very short-term. They don't really have long enough time for us to look at very closely. There are a couple of states that actually have done a really good job of having self-sufficient parks, but they are very few and far between.
And when we look at the cost of these parks, for example, I know that as a senior now, I am given the opportunity, I think, and I just sent some materials in, to be able to get a lifetime pass to the parks for a ridiculously low fee. I mean, are we undervaluing that which is available? Because so many people today seem to want to take advantage of these opportunities that we, the public, afford.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? For once you hit that senior status, you can get a golden age pass. I think it costs $20 now.
But that's why I just put in some paperwork so that I can get it before it goes up to, I think, $80.
Right. Okay. So for the rest of your life, even at $80, for the rest of your life, you can visit any national park in the United States and not pay any entry fee.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable?
It is remarkable. And think about when people are going to visit these parks, especially seniors that are going to visit these parks, are they walking in? Most of the time, they're taking their RV in there. They've got their all sorts of different recreation equipment that they're going in with. But yet, we are allowing them to go in the park at absolutely no cost.
I know. That is seems remarkable. What about all these organizations that are set up now outside of the federal sphere, like the National Park Foundation? And I get mailings from them, and I've given them donations in the past. What do they do to complement the work of the park system?
Okay, so most of our parks have some sort of partnership organizations. We have national partnership organizations, and then we have individual park organizations. And they literally are nonprofit organizations that are trying to assist parks in their management by raising funds for them, maybe providing some interpretive services for them. And they do a great job. It is a really nice way to have a partnership with the private sector and to help benefit those parks in those areas.
When you look at the federal lands, the public lands that we have today, and break it down, Holly Fretwell, any way that you'd like, what are some of the greatest challenges to being able to maintain these lands over time? For example, one of the areas that you write extensively about relates to fire suppression. I know that doesn't sound like something that we all think about very often, but it's an important part of the way that these lands are able to regenerate and regrow. Why don't we start there?
Okay. If we think about wildfire on our public lands, we're generally thinking about national forest lands. Again, the national forest lands are actually managed by the Department of Agriculture. And they are to be used or to be managed for multiple uses. And I think this multiple use mandate is what brings us to one of the biggest problems with our public lands management. Both our Bureau of Land Management and our Forest Service management are to be managed for multiple uses. And multiple uses include a whole bunch of different aspects, as we talked about previously, right? We're talking about recreation and timber extraction and grazing and mining and biodiversity and fish habitat and wildfire.
A lot of competing interests.
And all these different competing interests. And these are the lands that are owned by all Americans, right? So we all have some different ideas as to how they should be managed. So when we see this controversy over the landscape as to how we should manage them, whether we should manage them to allow wildfire or not allow wildfire amongst all these different issues, what we really need to know first if we're managing them well is what are we managing them for? Multiple use does not give our managers any priority in which to allocate the various resources. And so when they decide they're going to manage in one way, there's numerous groups that come up and say, no, wait a minute, we would like to see these lands managed in a different way. And I don't care which different issue that you want to be managing for, you're putting into those blanks there, they're always going to have somebody else that disagrees with how these lands should be managed because we're supposed to be managing for all these different uses. So if we go back to wildfire and think about what's going on in the landscape there, if you go back in the history of the Forest Service was actually set up to provide for timber production, mm-hmm. that is to grow trees, to cut them, to use for building homes, et cetera, and for a consistent supply of water. What we see in the early years of the Forest Service is sort of just this maintenance sort of maintenance management, if you will, as eventually after World War II, we start flowing into really looking at cutting timber and harvesting a lot of timber to the point of perhaps cutting too much timber, depending upon how you want to define what that rotational aspect for the forest will be. But we were harvesting a lot of timber in areas that were not going to regrow really well. We were spending more cutting that timber than the value of the timber itself. So we saw an extreme growth in timber harvest until the late 1980s. And then we had a lot of environmental concerns. And as we became a more wealthy nation, we had a lot more people that were interested in getting out into recreation and were more concerned about the environment. And suddenly we started to have these petitions against these big timber harvest and clear cuts. And essentially over the next 20 or so years, the environmentalists won that timber war, if you will, and we moved that pendulum from maybe cutting too much timber to not cutting enough. If you go back into the late 1980s, we were cutting 12 billion board feet from the Forest Service. If you look at today's timber harvest on an annual basis, it's somewhere between 2 and 3 billion board feet. So we've had more than a 70% decline in timber harvest.
So what does that mean in terms of the possibility of a fire and how we react to that?
Right. What that means is that now we have these areas that some that were previously managed and some that were not previously managed, actively managed by humans. And now we're sort of taking our hands off. And so we have all this regrowth that's going on in there. And we have much more dense forests that are more subject to huge conflagrations. And it's hard to generalize in the forest because there's so many different types of forests. And some forests have a natural burn cycle of, say, every 5 to 25 years. And that is that every 5 to 25 years, wildfire will come in. It will burn the ground. It will burn some of the smaller trees, but it will leave the bigger trees standing. And it gives those bigger trees more room to grow. It allows them more sunlight. It allows them more nutrients. So they become a very healthy forest and that has some wide open spaces underneath. Those forests that have missed 3, 4, or 5 fire cycles have become really dense forests. Instead of having these nice big trunks, they have these little spindly trunks that you could actually put your hand around. They're all really tight together. They've created a totally different type of habitat, and they've also are much more subject to a huge wildfire conflagration that would take the entire thing down. If you look at other forest types, some forest types require fire in order to regenerate, and they just start to look sort of doggy after a certain number of years. They burn every 100 to 200 years on average, historically speaking. So our fire suppression hasn't changed that type of forest a whole heck of a lot. We still see a big conflagration when it comes through those areas, but that would have been the natural process anyway. So we can't just talk about forest as fire is good or fire is bad, because fire is very different in every
But hasn't
forest.
There been a but, philosophy over the years to try to really put out these fires as opposed to perhaps managing them or using them as one of nature's tools? Have we been a little over-aggressive and even over-budgeted for some of that?
I would say most definitely. We've known for many, many years that fire is a natural part of the forest process. But nonetheless, we have continued to suppress fire for nearly 100 years, over 100 years in many cases, in forests that should be allowed to burn and in forests that maybe we want to see for other purposes. But we continue to provide this sort of blank check to fight the fire rather than to manage for allowing a more natural type of wildfire or for allowing us to do some different types of rotational forestry and restoration so that we prevent these huge conflagrations. We can't prevent fire from coming. It is natural in the forest. But we can do active management to reduce the type of conflagration that may come into the forest.
Another area for the future to look at, because we're seeing battles today over these national monument designations, and I don't want to confuse this with some of the controversies that are present today, but these are other controversies, from Bear's Ears in southeastern Utah to the North Woods of Maine. Explain what's going on there with these national monument designation disturbances.
Okay, so national monuments are generally proclaimed on existing federal lands, but what happens when we proclaim it a national monument is that we tend to restrict the different types of uses that can take place on that landscape. So I'm going to take us back to 1996 when President Clinton proclaimed the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, nearly 2 million acres in southern Utah, setting aside all this land and essentially eliminating the mining that was taking place and that was being proposed to take place on that landscape. So again, it changes the uses that are allowed for on the landscapes. Presidents can do this under the Antiquities Act, and presumably it's supposed to be the smallest area that we're able to protect the cultural and historic types of artifacts that they're looking at protecting in those regions. And when we're looking at, say, the Bear's Ears or the Grand Staircase Escalante, we're talking about millions of acres that have been set aside. Is that too big? Comes down to a question of what is it that we're really trying to protect. But it definitely changes the types of activities that can be done on that landscape.
What about Hawaii and off the coast of Hawaii? Before Barack Obama left as president, didn't he do something relative to the oceans around Hawaii?
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with what went on in the Hawaii case, but yes, he did set aside some sort of wildlife preserves to give it some sort of national monument-like status in the ocean. Again, my understanding, what we're essentially doing there is we're restricting the types of uses that we can do on that waterway, if you will, or that region of the ocean. So again, it's a president basically signing away and saying we're no longer going to be doing certain types of uses on this landscape, regardless of what those values are and how those values are going to impact the local citizens. I think one of the biggest problems when we look at national monument proclamations is that they really do not involve the local citizens, and the local citizens are the ones that are going to be most impacted by land management in their region.
When we look at land management, when we look at the park system, I mean, what kind of appreciation do you think the public has? Because I've been reading where the use of this land has been growing. People are looking for healthy, you know, outlets, and these are wonderful places to experience so much wonder. We see states even advertising their national parks, I think in the case of Utah, saying that they have 5 of them. I mean, what is the usage like, and then what is the political pressure from that greater usage? You know, what does that suggest?
Well, certainly our destination parks and the popular parks, the famous parks, are getting more and more use. We have a lot of parks under the national park system that exist out there that get very, very little use. But we have a lot of parks that are becoming over-congested at the same time. And we're hearing stories about decreasing quality of visits because so many people are coming to visit these parks, and we don't have good mechanisms in most cases to reduce the number of visitors or to make reservations to be able to visit parks. So we have people driving around looking for parking spots. If you go into Yellowstone this time of year, you will be following a path of cars, and when you go into a parking lot to try to get out and walk around, you will likely have to drive around a little bit to find a parking spot there. If you have to use the restroom, there are probably far more parking spots than there are availability of restrooms in that particular region. So there are certainly some problems that exist in that regard. When we look at our state parks, most of them are much less popular. And personally, it's kind of nice to go visit a state park or a national forest or something else that's not quite as popular in my own mind, because I'm not going to run into as many people and I'm not going to have the same congestion type issues. Many of our state parks as well, sometimes it's because they're just not as popular, and other times it's because they do some sort of congestion pricing. They actually price things a little bit higher during really peak seasons to try to encourage people to come in the shoulder season. They allow for better reservations so that when you're going to a museum or something, if it's overpopular, you're not waiting in line to get into it, you can actually have a reservation to go visit. So they're just doing a different type of management that actually is using the market a little bit more to try to allocate how people are visiting and when they're visiting.
What about the sensitivity to the natural occupants? We've read about lots of folks going into Yosemite or Yellowstone and having encounters with nature and not being terribly respectful of the bears and the coyotes and others. What we haven't really talked about the animals within. Tell us what threats they're under today.
Well, certainly the more people we have in there, the more impact we're going to have on that wildlife. And I think one thing that people need to understand when they're visiting these areas is that these are wild animals. They're not zoos. Our national parks are not zoos. They really are wild animals. They really can hurt you. And we have a lot of people that go in that don't pay attention to that. We've had people in Yellowstone that walk up to bison to take pictures that have been gored from that. We have people that have issues with bears because they leave their food out. We have people in Yellowstone that walk off the boardwalk and have literally fallen into some of the hot water and burned themselves or even died. And it's simply because people are not paying attention to the risks and the reality of what exists in these national parks.
How excited are you about the future of public lands in America? Is it something that you have been working in this field for a long period of time? PERC.org, very involved in these issues. Holly Fretwell is our guest today. I mean, what do you get excited about thinking about in terms of trying to resolve problems that can help maintain these parks for another 200 years?
My optimism is not huge because I see we have so many problems in these areas that we really need to take a lot of steps to ensure that we're going to have these areas and the beauty that exists in them and the recreation access as well and the timber and commodity production that we need to live the lifestyle that we live in the future. I do see a lot of people that are getting really frustrated with the way things are working today, and I think that's what it's going to take in order for us to make some changes in order to get better management. And I really think to get better management, we need to see some more local control. So those individuals that are living next to these landscapes, that are the ones that are really benefiting from the beauty of the landscape, from the production of the landscape, and they're also the ones that are going to suffer the largest burden from poor stewardship of the landscape. Those are the individuals that really need to have a bigger say in how these lands are going to be managed.
In closing, Holly, would you pay tribute to some of the people, some of the great individualists who have found that they have devoted their entire life to the land? And whatever their role has been, I recall doing a piece on radio several years ago about a lonely ranger who was the beacon, the sentinel, and he lived this very austere life trying to look out for these lands to make certain that if he saw danger or fire or whatever it might be, that he could warn people. I mean, give a little tribute to some of the people who are out there to protect and preserve.
Well, I'm going to give a tribute to somebody that's probably not been thought of in this particular realm, and that is to Terry Anderson, our former director of PERC. Mm. He really brought to light the idea of free market environmentalism, and I really think that in order to protect these lands into the future, we need to make sure that we have the incentives aligned well so that those people that are managing the lands are benefiting from taking really good care of the lands and stewarding those lands. And I think under the existing political systems that we have and the political type management that we have, that is not the way it is working, and we really need to work hard to better align those incentives so that we can get better management on the landscape.
Holly Fretwell, the Outreach Director and Research Fellow at Property and Environment Research Center. I thank you so much for coming on today and talking about one of America's best ideas, and maybe we need some new ideas to make certain that it can go forward and be the true joy that it is to all of us. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some rankings, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
Nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know, but we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us. But.
Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms, and John, this is really easy, at Trends Podcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check it out now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends Podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that, too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using the hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more, because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste, and you get more programming like this, and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works
Absolutely.
For all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. Let us out.
What's that?
Let us out.
Let us out. No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time, and we're posting on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.